From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. And here are the issues. Democrats Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders clashed in their ninth televised debate, disagreeing strongly over how the next president should treat Israel and the Palestinians. In the Republican race, Donald Trump complained that he is being cheated out of delegates to the National Convention, where the presidential nomination will be decided in July. In the Baltic Sea, Russian warplanes buzzed within yards of an American destroyer. The planes were unarmed, and national security experts argued over whether the American strategy against ISIS, the terrorist group, is succeeding. Well, let's start with, we've talked about this so many times, Michael, I'll start with you, these debates. I think there have been 11 Republican presidential debates, and now this is the ninth Democratic debate. I don't know about you, I'm getting a little tired. I don't think we heard much new in this most recent one between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, but here's my question. What is it that keeps Hillary Clinton having trouble with Bernie Sanders? And I think there's general agreement that Hillary Clinton, who's way ahead in delegates, will win the Democratic presidential nomination, and yet Bernie Sanders persists.
Well, there's a certain Clinton fatigue that happens no matter who will run against Hillary Clinton. They'll get a voice. They'll get an opportunity to express themselves. Bernie Sanders is very cleverly and very effectively sort of donned the Democratic suit, if you will, because he's not really a Democrat. He is a socialist,
yeah,
quite clearly. But in order to speak to Democrats, he has run as a Democrat. Mm-hmm. And he's done it very effectively, speaking to these very populist views that sort of take Donald Trump's populism and turn it right on its head.
Mm-hmm.
He is honest in the extreme. He is oddly appealing with his disheveled, frumpy look, mm-hmm. His preachy type of voice, which somehow speaks to a generation that's two generations separate from him.
Mm-hmm.
Look, he has made some very, very good points, and he's raised some of the very obvious weaknesses in any Clinton campaign. It's not very hard to do. Will he win? No. But has he affected this race mm-hmm. and the course of the Democrat Party for the long term? Oh, certainly he has.
Mm-hmm. You know, Michael does make one point, and Hillary Clinton makes this point as well, and I don't blame her, that that Bernie Sanders, when he ran for mayor of Burlington, Vermont, and then a House member from Vermont, and now several times now, of course, a senator from Vermont, has run as an independent.
Right.
And not a Democrat. Now, he caucuses with the Democrats in the Senate, but that's not the same thing. And she makes the point, well, look, this guy's a newcomer to the Democratic Party.
Right. And what this has all exposed, including on the Republican side with Donald Trump, is that voters, actual voters, are not as hooked to party labels as the party apparatus mm-hmm. and party establishments are. And so you have this phenomenon where somebody can come in and basically rent space on a party's mm-hmm. ticket, or not the mm-hmm. ticket, but on the ballot mm-hmm. with both Trump mm-hmm. and with Sanders. And through sheer force of personality and through their message, through a populist message, really tap into what's happening out there with the people. And I think in both the case of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, I think they captured something that they didn't even maybe anticipate. Mm-hmm. I think in both cases, I think Bernie Sanders and Jane Sanders, his wife, has said as much, that they've been surprised mm-hmm. by how well they've done, how much money they've mm-hmm. raised mm-hmm. just in small amounts over the internet, way more than Hillary last month.
Yeah.
So it's this kind of global phenomenon with the American electorate that has really captivated this campaign.
Yeah, you mentioned something, Linda, there about raising money. You mean what normally happens in a presidential race, if you're behind and everyone agrees or most people agree that you're not going to win the nomination eventually, you lose your ability to raise money. And yet mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders, I think it's the last 3 months, has raised more money than Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
It is remarkable. I don't quite understand it.
I think it's a lot of people sending a message. In particular, it's a lot of young people, but also older people. You know, I call them aging hippies, people who were you know, protesting the Vietnam War in the 1960s and early 70s and maybe even served in Vietnam, but have now gone way to the left. And they're just, they know, I think, deep down that Hillary will get the nomination, but they just, they want to push her to the left, which they've succeeded in doing in a number of ways. And they just, this is just a message to the party that you can't just give us the same old, and that there are people out there who are hurting, that free trade has hurt a lot of people, and you haven't followed through on your promises to help those who are left behind when jobs move overseas.
Michael, has Hillary been hurt by the persistence of Bernie Sanders staying in the race? And he criticizes her pretty strongly on her speech fees from Wall Street groups. They disagree in the Middle East and a few other things.
I think it's hurt her in the sense that it's sort of pierced this bubble of inevitability, if there ever was one, really, for this campaign. But certainly done that. But he hasn't said anything that any Republican candidate wouldn't say in the general election. He's not bringing up anything new. It does hurt a little bit in terms of making her a less appealing candidate in the general election. So if he manages to make people less enthusiastic about her and say, well, I'd rather stay home than vote for Hillary Clinton, then he really has hurt her, and he has hurt the party. And he's really messed up that rented space that Lynn talks about and probably will lose his security deposit.
Is this too many debates?
I can't say that it is too many. I think that every single opportunity to reach people is a good one. I'm in the camp that, let's have more, and let's have them all actually on broadcast TV, by the way.
Okay. Yeah, what do you think? Is this too many debates? I happen to think there are too many. I mean, there are other ways that the candidates reach voters and so on, is it? But now it seems these presidential campaigns and also the campaigns for lower offices are all anchored to debates on television.
I think for those of us who have to watch them for work, it feels like too much. But I think for voters, it's not too much. The most voters don't
religiously watch
every debate. Right. So this is an opportunity to see these people unfiltered. And I think the more information, the better. So I say let her rip.
Okay, Donald Trump. Has he got a legitimate gripe? You know, he says in Colorado, gee, they didn't have a caucus, they didn't have a primary, and yet they named all these delegates, and they're not for me.
Does he have a legitimate gripe? In a word, no. Let me expound on that. Okay. It's really peculiar. It's so odd to me that a guy who's so for dismantling all the federal centralized initiatives that are in government and devolving power to the states wants a centralized system, and this is all of a sudden too complicated for him. Look, I doubt that Donald Trump would come to the table in any negotiation and not have every single detail worked out and not have every seat filled with a lawyer that knows every single in and out of a state, county, municipality that he's dealing in. The idea that he is either too naive or too incompetent to get this right is astonishing, that the system is rigged. Let me say again, there are no billionaire outsiders.
Okay. Well, let's take a short break, and we'll be right back with more issues in the news and more about Donald Trump.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with Linda Feldman and Michael Williams. Linda, what about this complaint? I mean, Bernie Sanders has complained before that he's not getting a fair shake. I mean, he is the front runner among the Republicans, but he's not getting a fair shake here, and the Republican National Committee's mean to him, and now it's the state of Colorado that had a convention rather than a caucus or a primary, and all the delegates went to Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz went and spoke to the convention. Donald Trump didn't. And my own view is that, and this applies across the board, but particularly to Donald Trump, that nobody likes a whiner.
Right. I think Michael is correct. I think Donald Trump has nobody to blame for but himself for losing all those delegates in Colorado. But I do think both both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have a point about these delegate selection processes. It's very complicated. American elections, a lot of the way they run is at the state level. So the parties, which are private organizations, they're private clubs in some ways. They can mm-hmm. set their own rules. And they allow the states to set rules state by state. So Donald Trump could have learned those rules, but didn't. But it is a very complicated process. And on the Democratic side, you have all these superdelegates who are going to hand the nomination to Hillary.
And who are they?
The superdelegates are, it's basically the establishment. It's the party leaders, it's elected officials, state by state, who can just pick whoever they want. They're not bound by any voter preferences.
Mm-hmm.
So I think after, when all is said and done, what this election has shined a light on is the complicated delegate processes on both sides, and I think we'll see after the election maybe some revisiting in both parties.
Well, the Republicans, they leave it to the states, and the states can sort of do what they want. I think most states now want to have primaries or caucuses, but a convention is the way they used to really pick delegates over the years, but it's a little too complicated for Donald Trump. I just think he misjudged. This is all about, I'll give speeches and I'll be in debates and I'll be saying things in public and I'll call up TV and radio stations in the morning when I get up and so on, and that's all I need to do. And it takes more than that.
Yeah, it came back to bite him a little bit, mm-hmm. Just whole idea of like popularity, winning mm-hmm. all. You mm-hmm. have to have people who understand the rules of the game. And mm-hmm. if you don't understand mm-hmm. them yourself, you better find somebody who does. Plenty of people around here in Washington.
He's hiring a few now. A little late. Anyway, let's turn to what went on in the Baltic Sea. Linda, what were these Russian planes doing flying so close? It seemed like somebody called it a simulated attack. These were not armed Russian planes, but flying so close to an American destroyer in the Baltic Sea.
Right, they're just sending a signal. It was in international waters, so it wasn't, nothing illegal happened, mm-hmm. but it's provocative, it's dangerous, there could have been a mishap, their lives could have been lost. This is the Russians sending a signal over the West's aggressive posture in NATO, they're expanding, NATO is boosting up its presence in the Baltics and in Poland. And I think this is the Russians just sending a message.
It seems to me, Michael, that a mistake could have been made here. I gather they could visually, correct me if I'm wrong, they could visually see that these planes were not armed. Right. Am I right about that? I think so.
I believe so.
But in any case, what if they had visually gotten it wrong? It would seem they could have fired on these Russian planes. It could have been, it seems to me, it comes pretty close to being a disaster.
Yeah.
From the outside, it certainly does look that way. And to me, what this is just Putin has pulled largely out of the Middle East. He's declared mm-hmm. His intention to pull troops out of the whole Syria situation. And quite rightly, you say that he is much more concerned now with Europe and with NATO and U.S. expansion mm-hmm. there. And I think this is also some saber rattling to mm-hmm. cover up the noise being made mm-hmm. from an economy that is grinding to a halt. Mm-hmm. With dropping oil prices, with an economy that's, 43% based on oil and gas revenues, there are problems there. They're dipping mm-hmm. into reserve funds to build mm-hmm. infrastructure and to bail out banks. There are real, real problems there. And mm-hmm. Putin's go-to strategy is to take off the shirt and do some military function in order to draw attention away from the problems that are really affecting people on a day-to-day basis in that economy.
Linda, one more question on this. Should Putin feel threatened by NATO? I mean, it obviously has expanded in mm-hmm. some of the countries that were in the Warsaw Pact with the Soviet Union years ago are members of NATO now. It's always been a defensive agreement, but should he be upset about it?
It's not as if NATO is about to invade Russia, but I think what Putin should do and what he will do are two different things. I think Putin is reflective of the Russian upset over the collapse of the Soviet Union and about Russia's sense of itself, of that Russia is really more than just the boundaries of the current Russian Federation, that greater Russia includes, say, Ukraine. You know, Kiev and Rus was the historical base of Russian identity. And any encroachment of NATO toward greater Russia makes just drives them crazy. They want to be respected. They want to be perceived as a major player on the world stage. And as NATO sort of reminds them and beefs up that they're, you know, that they have lost some of that major global identity, I think that kind of drives them crazy, and it makes Putin do things that we react to.
You know, there's some Americans that sort of agree with Putin that NATO's not playing a useful role anyway. I mean, Donald Trump has said NATO's obsolete, and I don't think he said that if I were president, I'd pull out of NATO, but he certainly has hinted at that. What do you think?
Well, I think clearly that Putin does not agree that NATO is obsolete. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, he would not react to the actions of expansion the way that he does. Mm-hmm. If he thought it was obsolete, he would not care. And he does. He does have a point, and I agree with you, Linda, that Soviet sphere of influence shrinking affects him greatly. But it is not obsolete, and both sides have to deal with the feelings around how it's positioned and will be positioned in the next 10 to 15 years.
Let's turn to ISIS. We always turn to ISIS.
We always do.
Seems like. But the debate has picked up, Linda, about whether the American strategy is being effective against ISIS. And I think you can argue it both ways. You could say, well, look, they've shrunk the ground that's held by ISIS in Iraq and Syria and so on. On the other hand, ISIS has popped up in other countries and even in lone wolf attacks in the United States.
Right. ISIS, the physical present, the physical, quote, boundaries of ISIS, the sort of rump state of ISIS in Syria and Iraq is easier to go after than the ideology and the almost cult-like reach that it has through social media. So while we have made progress in reducing the forces in Iraq and Syria and also in squeezing its financial resources, attacking its oil assets, you know, getting at these radicalized Muslims in Europe and in the United States is much more difficult. And I think, you know, Obama went to the CIA this week to talk up how he has the progress that's been made against ISIS. But the reality is that they're still, I think, kind of floundering on ISIS reach through social media.
Time for one more break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct.
And adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with Michael Williams and Linda Feldman. Michael, ISIS, the debate goes on. Where are you in this debate?
Yeah, it was down to a couple of different sectors, if you will, on how we're winning that war. Mm-hmm. On the ground, yeah, there has been a lot of progress in, I think, what is it called, Operation Inherent Resolve. 27,000,
suppose
it. Yeah, 27,000 ISIS troops that have been killed, 11,000 some airstrikes. There's been a lot of military action. A lot of it has done a lot of good. But look, all that doesn't mean anything unless you have the boots on the ground to both keep that land and also the shoes under the table at the negotiating table to make sure that the governmental and bureaucratic things that need to be done to make people safe get into place. Now, the other place is in the intelligence realm. And I saw a fascinating article where an ex-Syrian head of state, I think foreign minister, was saying that he believed and was quite sure that the Syrian government and ISIS were working together, the Syrian intelligence agency. We have fallen so far behind in the intelligence group, especially in the European theater. We've got to ramp up that intelligence ability in order to really neutralize the threats that may be there. For now, we don't even know what that threat is. We don't know how many combatants there are really in Europe undercover, or in the United States for that matter, for sure.
One part of the argument by people who say a stronger and different effort needs to be made by the United States against ISIS is that the strategy has relied very heavily on airstrikes, right, and what is needed are more ground troops.
Right.
Linda?
Yeah, no, this is, I think, going to be really one of the important ramifications of the November elections here. Whoever is elected president, we may see a quite different attitude and posture toward the fight against ISIS. I mean, you've got Hillary Clinton, who wants to set up a no-fly zone over Syria. You've got Ted Cruz saying he wants to, you know, carpet bomb. Mm-hmm. Lord knows what Donald Trump would do. So it's, yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. it's, you know, Obama has sent in some special operations forces, but really is keeping this on the air, in the air and not on the ground. And, it's, you know, it's really tough.
Yeah.
Michael,
the humanitarian crisis mm-hmm. does not stop until, mm-hmm. until boots are on the ground and somebody mm-hmm. can enforce the peace and allow people to come back to their homes mm-hmm. and live normal lives.
I want to go back to one issue that I suggested in the introduction and then didn't raise when we were talking about the debate between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, and that is the question of Israel and the Palestinians. Linda, clearly Bernie Sanders was actually very clear in criticizing Hillary mm-hmm. Clinton for not being concerned about the Palestinians. What about that?
That was, for Bernie Sanders, that was just the classic left position. And it's a little ironic, obviously, Bernie Sanders is Jewish, but he is not necessarily doing well with the Jewish community, mm-hmm. with Jewish Democrats, because he is so far to the left and evinces so much sympathy toward the Palestinians. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was a difference between them. Michael, what about it?
Yeah, I think that...
one push by Bernie Sanders, by the way.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders did give the classic view of someone who I think has not been at the table saying, hey, let's give the Palestinians a chance and right. two-party state and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And you could almost hear the eye rolling from Hillary Clinton as someone who has sat at the table for years and mm-hmm. years mm-hmm. and years and watched very good potential solutions be just destroyed right. by the number of parties that do not really want a solution sitting at the table. Mm-hmm. There is frustration. So I guess mm-hmm. you have hope on Bernie Sanders' part, mm-hmm. but I think you have again, that mm-hmm. rigid practicality mm-hmm. that embodies Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm.
There was one thing that I think was a mistake by Bernie Sanders, and when he said he thought that 10,000 innocent Palestinians had been killed in the Gaza when the several years ago when the Israelis sent in troops, mm. seemed like a very high number. Turned out it was a very high number, and Hillary Clinton didn't jump on him, but. Some members of the media did.
Right. I mean, this debate was interesting because Bernie Sanders is really under the gun to show his expertise on issues. He had very badly fumbled an interview with the editorial board at the New York Daily News. He couldn't explain his policies. He couldn't answer questions on policy. And this debate was his big chance on the national stage to kind of redeem himself on that score. And I thought, actually, he didn't do that badly. But he still is clearly out of his depth compared to Hillary Clinton, who has so much experience and is so qualified.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of hard when you're debating a former Secretary of State. She was Secretary of State for 4 years, personally involved in all these issues. A point she makes about, well, I was in the room and there were just four of us, the president, myself, and these other two people. It's kind of hard to top that.
It really is. I mean, and I agree in the interview that Bernie Sanders had. I mean, he was almost Palin-esque in the way that he sort of fumbled some of those questions. It was bad.
I thought you were going to say Trumpian.
Well, that too. Yeah, Trumpian. It was Trumpian.
You put it Trumpian and Palin-esque. We get...
Yeah, when you read some of these transcripts of Trump with the Washington Post, particularly with the New York Times on foreign policy, there's a lack of knowledge.
It really was a lack of knowledge, and Hillary has just a superior amount of knowledge. Again, she's going to have to use that as a cudgel against him in the coming.
You know, I should have an answer to this. Was this the last debate, this one in Brooklyn?
It's the last scheduled debate. Okay. So you can call it the last debate, but put an asterisk on it. I don't know that Hillary will agree to any more.
Well, if I were she, I wouldn't. But who's ever behind always wants more debates.
That's right. And after New York, it could really effectively be all over for Bernie.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, it's all over for us, too. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief of the Christian Science Monitor, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes. of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.